Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcast, or it's simpler to use a smartphone or a computer with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from France 24, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, and NHK Japan. We will begin with France 24. In Lebanon, the explosion of thousands of pagers on Tuesday led to deaths, many injuries, and panic. Israel has not claimed the terror attack, but the international press does not doubt the source. Then on Wednesday, thousands of walkie-talkies exploded with more deaths, injuries, and panic. France 24 press reviews are always a good insight into the response that events have on various nations. So first we will hear the Wednesday press reviews from Lebanon, Israel, and some European papers on the Tuesday terror attack. Then press reviews from Wednesday on the second wave of attacks. France 24.
Let's start perhaps with the Lebanese press and what they're saying.
Absolutely. Let's have a look first at the front page of this pro-Hezbollah paper, Al Akhbar, where the headline reads, "Assassination without rules," or lawless assassination, you might say. As you can imagine, Hezbollah are extremely angry, as are their sympathisers, about this attack. But it doesn't stop there. L'Orient Le Jour, which is much more critical of Hezbollah, a French-speaking paper in Lebanon, has on the front page the pages of terror, referring to this as the biggest ever security failing within Hezbollah, and pointing out that the Lebanese authorities are calling this a war crime. If we look at the inside pages, it's extremely condemnatory, extremely angry. It says, "The beep that kills," is the title of that article. It reads, "Rather than searing proof of its technological superiority, this is another jewel in Israel's resolutely terrorist crown." And it says, "Like in Gaza, there has been no concern for the collateral victims." So you can see just the way that the national press are reeling from this attack. There are some different takes on this in the Israeli press. Let's start with the Jerusalem Post. Now, this headline, as you can see, a Lebanon pager blast. Hezbollah has no idea what hit it. That is a positively jubilant headline. And the question this article asks is the same as what we're asking. Will this be the knockout punch for Hezbollah? Now, the article says that although Hassan Nasrallah has threatened retaliation, it seems to suggest the belief that Hezbollah might be a little bit more likely to decide that they can't beat Israel militarily and as such back down. This article is extremely optimistic. That's a view that is, from an Israeli point of view, that's not shared by Haaretz. Haaretz is extremely condemnatory of the attack. It says, "Pager blast humiliated Hezbollah, but they won't win any wars for Israel." And this article says, up until now, the Hezbollah strategy has been to bleed Israel, to hurt Israel through the missile strikes in the north, but has shown no interest in an all-out war. Now, though, that could change because of the scale of this attack. The thesis of this article is that at a time when not so long ago Netanyahu was promising the Israeli people a victory in Gaza, Israel now seems closer than ever to a full-out war on a brand new front. Times of Israel has another piece discussing what Israel's sort of military options are in Lebanon. Its headline, "While still in Gaza, Israel has no good options in Lebanon, but it may invade anyway." This analysis piece says that short of flooding the ground in Lebanon with Israeli troops, Israel doesn't have particularly strong options for defeating Hezbollah, and that action would in fact be ill-advised. Israel is war-weary and yet to succeed with the much smaller group Hamas in Gaza. This article seems to suggest that the pager operation was useful for Israel in that it may put Hezbollah on the back foot, on the defensive, and buy Israel time. The article seems to suggest that war with Hezbollah is nothing short of inevitable and makes no suggestion that peace should be the medium-term objective for Israel on that front. This attack is being hailed as the stuff of spy fiction. The Financial Times has this interesting piece that says exploding pages join long history of killer communications devices. In other words, this attack was a surprise, but it's not out of character for the Israeli authorities. Israeli spies have a long history of this kind of thing, as Olive was explaining to us. In 1972, Mossad killed a PLO representative in Paris by stuffing the base of his home phone with explosives. And in 1996, Shin Bet tricked a Hamas bomb maker, Ayash, into accepting a phone call from his father on a Motorola telephone that was stuffed with explosives also. And the article also points out, of course, that a phone is a double-edged weapon. It allows you to identify and also surveil your victim before then being the weapon of attack.
We'll stick to you, starting with the reactions from that second wave of exploding devices in Lebanon, Dipti.
Yes, Stuart, dominating the front pages today. Let's show you a few of those papers. This is La Croix, the French paper, which talks about new weapons of war, new weapons in the war between Israel and Hezbollah. Corriere della Sera, that's the Italian daily here on its front page today, wondering if Lebanon is on the brink of war as well. Let's turn our focus to the regional papers there. This is L'Orient Le Jour, the Lebanese daily here, which says after the metaphorical earthquake, it's time for response now. After that second consecutive exploding devices attack in Lebanon, the paper says that there is little doubt that Israel is behind it and warns of a war opening up in a whole new front. It's hard to see how Hezbollah will come out of this unscathed, the paper says. Now, for the pan-Arab paper Al-Quds, on its front page, also looking at the possibility of at least affirming that for this paper as well, there's no doubt that Israel was behind it. And with this new attack, the possibility of war increases. And now, on the Al-Quds website, there's a very interesting article here penned by a Palestinian researcher and journalist called Yasser Manah. Now, he wonders how Hezbollah could actually benefit from all of this, these, quote, silent bombings. It's worth noting that this writer himself has been imprisoned several times in Israel in the past. Now, he evokes the idea that this attack must have had the support of the U.S., even going as far as saying that he thinks Washington may have even been the real puppet master behind the scenes. An attack of such audacity could also mean that Hezbollah is fully aware of the, quote, strategic card it possesses, and says that despite this blow, Hezbollah will most likely continue to adhere to its strategic project.
What about the reaction then, Dipti, from the Israeli press?
Well, you have a center-left paper, Haaretz, always more moderate in its coverage, that calls it a Hollywood-style pager attack that sent a clear message. Israel wants another redundant war. Gideon Levy writes in this article that we are in the midst of the most criminal and redundant war Israel has ever embarked upon, and it turns out that it wants another one. Now, from the more hardliner newspaper, the Jerusalem Post, this is the opinion page today. And you can see there's quite a few articles dedicated to this. Notably, the paper in its editorial really hails what it calls a technological takedown of Hezbollah after Tuesday and Wednesday's attacks, saying that they will dispel self-doubts about Israel, which is surrounded by enemies in the region. You have Haaretz, and then you have, so you really see sort of differing points of view there between Haaretz and Jerusalem Post.
Those press reviews were from France 24. France 24 may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. They're also available at most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. On to Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Janina Dill from the Oxford Institute for Ethics, Law, and Armed Conflict discusses international laws applicable to the terror attacks in Lebanon. Meta, whose products include Facebook and Instagram, has issued a total ban on Russian state media outlets, claiming they are using deceptive tactics to carry out covert influence operations online. Elon Musk refused to remove threads from Twitter, now called X, that led to attacks on Brazilian citizens and law enforcement. This led to X being banned in Brazil, fines imposed, and now money being seized from bank accounts belonging to X and Starlink. Musk is supporting the far-right politician Bolsonaro, who's leading protest in that country. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
The death toll from the latest wave of explosions targeting Hezbollah at its communications devices in Lebanon has risen to 25. The walkie-talkie bombs come the day after a dozen people were killed when pagers used by the militant group exploded almost simultaneously. Israel isn't commenting on the blasts, but its defense minister, Yoav Gallant, says a new phase in the war has begun. In the wake of the blasts, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned of a serious risk of dramatic escalation in Lebanon. He's also raised concern about the nature of the attack on Hezbollah's communications devices.
I think it's very important that there is an effective control of civilian objects, not to weaponize civilian objects. That should be a rule that everywhere in the world governments should be able to implement.
Janina Dill is a co-director of the Oxford Institute for Ethics, Law and Armed Conflict. Weaponizing an object used by civilians is strictly prohibited under international law. From a legal perspective, does it matter that those who appear to have been targeted are suspected Hezbollah operatives?
Yes, distinction requires that each attack in war here, each explosion of a device, is directed against an individual that the attacker knows or reasonably believes to be a legitimate target of attack. So Hezbollah fighters are legitimate targets of attacks, but crucially, not every member of Hezbollah is, only the fighting wing or members of its armed group. Even if these attacks were all intended to target Hezbollah fighters, the question from a legal point of view would still arise whether the attacking party, potentially Israel, had the means or intelligence to verify that the pages would actually land in the hands of the intended individuals, so Hezbollah fighters. Did Israel take any precautions, for instance, to ensure that the pages would be in the hands of fighters rather than civilians?
You're an expert on law and morality and war. What was your first thought when you heard about these attacks?
Well, placing a small explosive device directly on the body of a fighter in some sense is the ideal of an attack from the point of international law. Committing hundreds of those attacks simultaneously at the same time, on the other hand, is almost impossible to reconcile with international law. So we can imagine that Israel had intelligence that these pages were destined for the fighting wing of Hezbollah. So In that case, we may imagine that it complied with distinction. But there are additional considerations here. For instance, the principle of precautions demands that for each explosion, the anticipated civilian harm would be minimized as much as possible, for instance, through the timing of attack. And this is obviously very difficult to achieve when many attacks must go off simultaneously. Attackers must also conduct a proportionality calculation for each of these explosions. And if they don't have intelligence where the pagers would be at the time of explosion, that would be very hard to achieve.
Okay, just explain to me then what the difference is between a whole lot of smaller bombs going off, killing possibly hundreds or thousands of people, and one big bomb going off and killing perhaps hundreds of people.
Well, the question is whether the attacker retains control over the timing, the place, and the circumstances of the attack, And whether there's intelligence to, with this information, minimize the anticipated civilian harm. Right? With one big bomb going off, you presumably have some advance intelligence about the civilians surrounding the explosion, And through the timing, the angle of the attack, you can minimize that expected civilian harm. You can also weigh this expected civilian harm, or we sometimes call it collateral damage, to the anticipated military advantage. But with hundreds of similar small bombs going off at the same time, the attacker wouldn't know in advance whether there would be civilians surrounding these attacks, how the timing should be, when the attacks should go off in order to minimize civilian harm. And there would be very little intelligence that is required to actually conduct a meaningful proportionality calculation.
Well, in this case, I can tell you it's these bombs didn't go off in a war zone. They went off in public places.
Yes, I mean, there's currently an armed conflict between Hezbollah and Israel, so international law of war applies. But it is absolutely correct that most of these pagers, or many of these pagers, would have gone off in the midst of civilian areas. And since it wasn't possible for the attacker to anticipate the civilian harm, a meaningful proportionality calculation wouldn't have been possible, which is why this operation poses very, very serious challenges under international law.
And the UN has called for an independent investigation into the explosions. What could that investigation actually reveal, as a last question?
Well, many facts that are relevant for a legal analysis and that may be relevant politically, including the attributability of this operation to Israel, are still unclear. Surfacing these facts in a way that is credible is certainly legally and politically relevant. I think one potential political consequence that should come from this is that states awaken to the really operational danger of an overly permissive application of international law to personal communication devices in the context of war. Given how much terror this operation must have caused the civilian population in Lebanon, it will be really critical to clarify and strengthen states' commitment to their existing legal obligations and to clarify how exactly they apply in this particular context.
Janina Dill there from the Oxford Institute for Ethics, Law and Armed Conflict. Thanks for being on DW News.
Now, Meta has issued a total ban on Russian state media outlets, citing foreign influence activity and claiming the outlets have used deceptive tactics to carry out covert influence operations online. Now, Meta's platforms include Facebook and Instagram. The ban on outlets like Russian state broadcaster RT and Rossiya Segodnya comes after the US Justice Department charged RT employees with money laundering and producing content to influence the US presidential elections. Well, Russia, of course, has reacted angrily. Here's Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov.
Meta is discrediting itself with these actions. Such selective actions against Russian media are unacceptable. We have an extremely negative attitude towards this. And this, of course, complicates the prospects for normalizing our relations with Meta.
Brazil's dispute with tech billionaire Elon Musk is heating up. One of Brazil's Supreme Court justices ordered that fines of almost $3 million be seized from bank accounts belonging to the social media platform X and the satellite internet provider Starlink, both owned by Musk. The same Supreme Court justice who passed a ruling 2 weeks ago banning X in Brazil. For more, let's cross over to Fabio Jussai Silva. He's a Brazil studies professor and joins me from the capital, Brasilia. Fabio, this is not just a legal battle. It's also gotten pretty nasty. Elon Musk at one point even referring to the Brazilian Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes as Darth Vader. What is this battle really about?
I would say that this battle is really about a billionaire who is the owner of a large social media company refusing to follow basic orders from the Brazilian judiciary. So it's much more than, a disagreement between a company and a justice system. It's become a matter of Brazilian sovereignty.
And just walk us through a little bit what this legal battle has been about. It started with charges of disinformation.
It actually started because X was ordered to remove some posts and to suspend some profiles that were engaged in a doxing campaign against some Brazilian public officials. Police officers were conducting an investigation about some wrongdoings done by former President Bolsonaro. And X and Musk refused to comply with those orders because they, basically argued that they stand up for freedom of speech and they don't see the point of banning any type of speech on social media, even if that kind of speech is threatening to the safety, in this case, of a public official.
Now, Supreme Court Justice de Moraes went so far as to freeze the bank accounts of X and Starlink. Is that standard, and how necessary was that?
It's a quite severe measure, of course. But the reason why he did that was because Musk, and actually X, was fined for not complying with the previous orders. And after that, Musk removed the all the representatives of the company from Brazil, and so the basically the company stopped responding to the Brazilian judiciary, and there was nobody to pay for the fines or to be responsible for the fines. So he ordered the freezing of the assets of X as well as Starlink. When it comes to Starlink, it's a complicated question because it's a different legal entity than X. But Starlink is one of the investors of X, and technically this is possible under Brazilian law. There's a provision in Brazilian law that authorizes the disregarding of a legal entity and the judiciary to go after the owners of that company if they understand that the company has become just a shell for illegal acts.
Now, let's talk just briefly, if you can, about the reactions in Brazil. We're actually seeing some protesters siding with Elon Musk.
That's correct, because what Musk has done is to make his platform a partisan platform. He has developed very strong ties with the Brazilian far right, with the supporters of former President Jair Bolsonaro, some of whom have been convicted for participation in an attempted coup in January 8, 2023. And so, you know, they are using this momentum that's being generated by the clash between Musk and Moraes to also pressure the court, for instance, and pressure Parliament to give an amnesty to some of those people who were convicted and to, I guess, weaken the authority of the court so that it won't keep up with its investigations against Bolsonaro and some military officers involved in those events as well.
Professor Fabio Josiah Silva, thank you very much.
That interview and reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. They're also available at most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report, it could help support this program like a listener in Willits, California did this week. There's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com, or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever helped this freely distributed show stay airborne. Please join them. We will conclude with NHK World Radio Japan. A United States Navy aircraft flew through the Taiwan Strait, creating tension with China. Two German naval ships passed through this on Friday. The U.S. says it may sell $200 million worth of military hardware to Taiwan. There was another failure in attempts to remove highly radioactive waste from Fukushima nuclear power plant, which melted down 13 years ago. China and Russia continue to ban seafood from Japan because of wastewater being discharged from the facilities into the Pacific Ocean. NHK Japan.
A U.S. Navy aircraft flew through the Taiwan Strait on Tuesday, prompting China to send up fighter jets to monitor it. The passage is the latest show of strength in the region by Western nations as China steps up military pressure on Taiwan. The U.S. 7th Fleet said in a statement, a U.S. Navy P-8A Poseidon patrol and reconnaissance aircraft transited the Taiwan Strait in international airspace. China's Eastern Theater Command, which oversees the East China Sea, including Taiwan, said in a statement, Chinese fighter jets scrambled to pursue and surveil the U.S. aircraft. It criticized the transit, saying the U.S. is hyping it up publicly. A U.S. guided missile destroyer conducted a transit of the Taiwan Strait last month, and two German Navy ships passed through it on Friday for the first time in 22 years. Washington says it may sell over $200 million worth of military aircraft equipment to Taiwan. This is widely seen as a response to China, whose planes routinely fly near Taiwan. The State Department announced the return, repair, and reshipment of spare parts Monday and notified Congress of the potential sale. Taiwan's foreign ministry says this is the 16th time the Biden administration has provided arms to Taipei. The sale includes spare aircraft parts as well as logistical and technical support. In response, Taiwan vowed to strengthen its defense capabilities. The move will likely draw protests from China. The sale is being seen as an effort to keep the country in check as its military aircraft routinely cross the median line of the Taiwan Strait. Beijing has been demanding Washington end its military support for Taiwan. A test retrieval of nuclear fuel debris at the Fukushima Daiichi power plant was suspended Tuesday due to a camera problem. Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, says it had extended a retrieval device inside the containment vessel of reactor number 2 and lowered a tool on its tip to the bottom of the vessel. Tuesday's goal was to check the device's operation and the conditions inside the vessel. But the work was suspended because images from two of the device's four cameras could not be confirmed. The test removal of molten fuel, which mixed with parts of the reactor structure, began last week. TEPCO had hoped to remove the debris, but now the schedule for Wednesday and beyond is undecided. An estimated 880 tons of fuel debris remains in the number 1, 2, and 3 reactors. Removing it is considered the most challenging step in decommissioning the plant due to extremely high levels of radiation. Fukushima Daiichi was also a topic of conversation in Vienna this week. The chair of Japan's Atomic Energy Commission was there, stressing the safety of its treated and diluted water release. Uesaka Mitsuru's remarks followed a statement by Chinese officials describing the water as nuclear contaminated. Federal authorities in Russia are reportedly set to maintain a ban on Japanese seafood imposed since last year. They say the move is precautionary and tests show the fish are currently safe. The Kremlin's restrictions began after Japan started releasing treated and diluted water from the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant into the ocean. Russia's state-run TASS news agency and other media quoted the federal quarantine and sanitary chief on Wednesday. Sergei Dankvert reportedly says no abnormalities have been found in fish from Japan.
Those reports are from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They're heard at 10 p.m. at 11735 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp and most podcast sites. All the times they announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You will have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for making an online donation. There's a link at my website along with a podcast link and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. While I'm recuperating from spinal injuries, I am staying in a house that is connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.